Hello, Tiffany. Hi, how are you?
Hi, Deepti. So well. It's raining here currently. I was just sharing with you, and so it
Oh.
has a specific energy, but it's nice. It's cozy. It feels like we're in a cozy tea corner together. How
Oh,
are
that's nice. And yeah, all well. I think we have a sunny weather here. And so yeah, thank you so much for being on this podcast. And I have been looking forward to connect with you for a long time. I think lots of planning before we got into this call, but thank you so much for being there. And I really look forward to gaining a lot in terms of the way you have been, kind of living and propagating yoga and Ayurveda as a lifestyle. So I hope our listeners also get to learn a lot from the wide knowledge that you have in the field.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me also, Tiki. Thank you.
Great. So, Tiffany, I would just want to introduce you to the listeners first, and then we'll take it on to the session. So, Tiffany is the founder of Vichara Yoga and Rasa Ayurveda, and she's based out in Canada. She's an international yoga teacher and an Ayurvedic practitioner, sharing gifts of meditation, yoga, and Ayurveda globally. She conducts retreats, yoga teachers trainings, and immersions. She offers a unique offering of classical yoga that combines the fullness of tantric hatha yoga path along with the deep inquiry meditative presence. So, Tiffany, very deeply spiritual, of course, yoga and Ayurveda, but I think more on the spiritual side. So I think my first question to you is, how did you land at yoga and Ayurveda? Like, you found these two modalities, or these two modalities found?
Yeah, I think the latter. I think the latter. They found me. It really feels like that. And there was one Vaidya, one doctor that I studied with, and he would often ask the question, like, "Did any of you plan in elementary school?" And especially most of us were North Americans. Any of you plan in elementary school to be practicing or giving your life to Ayurveda and yoga or to become Ayurvedic doctors, right? So obviously, most of us not. I had never heard of it growing up in rural Canada. And I found my way to India because of my studies, which led me to work for NGOs, for organizations and charities, which found my way to India. And that was a very short-lived offering that I worked for such organizations because yoga
So
found.
this organization where you were working with, did it had any roots or connections to yoga and Ayurveda? It was like
Didn't, well, let's not say that. It didn't per se, but actually, I don't know if you've heard of Dr. Vandana Shiva at all, and she works especially in seed sovereignty and indigenous seed banks in the north of India, in Dehradun, in that area. And so
Which
originally
place in India is that? Because I also belong to North India.
in Dehradun.
Dehradun, oh yeah.
Yeah.
I think I've heard of that because I think because my journey into wellness started with something called macrobiotics, and the hub for macrobiotics at that time was Dehradun. And that's where I came to know there's a lot of people working on the seed stuff and all of that.
Oh, very good. Yeah. So there was a farm there, Navdanya, it's called, the organization and the farm.
I'm aware of that.
Yeah.
Yes, now I get it.
So that's how I ended up going to India. I felt really called to her work, which we could call Ayurvedic and yogic in that it has this deep recognition of oneness with the land, with Prakriti, with nature herself, and respect, reverence, this bhakti for life itself. So, but
I guess
then.
they were doing a lot of ground rice farming there, if I'm not wrong.
Yeah, I think now,
I'm aware of that.
today, Deepti, they have something like 450 varieties of rice alone on that farm.
Yes, I'm aware of
It's a
that.
wonder. It's a wonder. Yeah.
Yeah.
So this was how I ended up going to India, actually, that call. But then very quickly, one weekend, I went, or for a couple of days, I went to Rishikesh. And that's when yoga took my heart, and then Ayurveda followed quite quickly afterwards. And I thought I was going to India for half a year to a year. That was the idea. And but I was open. It was after my bachelor's, my undergrad, and then I didn't return actually to Canada for 4.5 years, the first time, just for a dip in to say hi, to be here, with family, and then I went back. And so I really had this ongoing. It was like an immediate love affair, some kind of long-standing relationship with
I can understand that this just happens to you. I mean, maybe some inner calling that pulls you.
yes. So
Great.
that's how it came. Yeah. So it found me for sure. It found me. I never imagined that I would
No,
ever,
I'm sure.
on a podcast talking about or sharing yoga and Ayurveda.
I know. So, like both of the modalities, you found both of them together, or you started learning yoga first and then you got into Ayurveda? And how did the merger happen? Like, because you talk a lot about yoga and Ayurveda both.
At first, I really got called to a yogic practice. Yoga can, and of course, inclusively meditation. So that was part of the practice. And from there, by being in the school and with the Swamiji that I was with for some time, there was always an introduction to as well Ayurveda and the principles, of course, of Mahabhutas, the five elements, which we find through all the Vedic sciences. And then, of course, a reverence for Ayurveda in especially the system of the body. You know, the body and our energy system. And so I started going to a couple Ayurvedic doctors, just had a gentle introduction to it, but nothing I intended to deeply study or to in any way become accredited in. That was definitely not the intent. My intention really was for the pinnacle of yoga, which is awakening. I mean, that's it, you know, I never went to yoga or to Ayurveda to become something or to get accredited. It has always really been for my own inner deepening and for my own inner self-knowing. So
Great.
that was
Yeah,
how
I think you just need a starting, because I remember when I learned yoga, like my first teacher used to tell us that yoga is such a powerful spiritual science that for the people it wants it to be there, it'll automatically pull. And for the people who've actually practiced for years and who are not meant for it, will not stay with it. And that's kind of a cycle that happens automatically.
Yes, absolutely.
Great. Yeah. So, Tiffany, my next question would be, like, you have been practicing classical Hatha yoga and merging Ayurveda together in your teachings and offerings and practices, like whatever you offer. How do you think the two sciences come together as a lifestyle? So, what I'm trying to discuss here is, on day-to-day basis, in daily life, how do yoga and Ayurveda practices can be kind of brought in for somebody who, for a normal person, for anybody, like, you know, I mean, we belong to this field, so of course we'll make an extra effort, but for somebody who wants to make it a lifestyle, maybe practicing say 1 hour of a yoga session in a day and then getting adopting certain Ayurveda practices to kind of bring the two things together, which also have a deep impact on how in the long run it affects their health
Yes,
or
absolutely.
overall well-being.
Yes, I think the important place to start at is always for each one of us to ask ourselves what our sankalpa is, you know, what our sacred intention is for our lives and for our days inclusively. I don't even mean, you know, long term what the intention is for our lives, but this day that we have ahead of us, what's the intent for our day? And if we get more clear on that, we can get clear on what we want to spend doing in our days, you know, how we want our days
That's
to.
so beautiful, yeah.
And if we're not clear on that, then our days kind of move from autopilot. They just move from conditioning. You know, we've been told that we should have a job, we should move in this way, we should do these things. And we're told a lot from media messaging that we should spend a lot of time, you know,
That's
scrolling,
so true. Yes.
eating, you know, foods that are more entertainment than actual nourishment, etc. So I feel it begins from the attitude, really, like this bhava. You know, what's the attitude that we take into our day? And then yoga and Ayurveda become actually a natural arising, not something of the mind that we press upon our lives. Because if we ask ourselves what yoga and Ayurveda are, yoga, of course, as you know, coming from this word yoke, means to be really in the absolute uniting with any given moment,
Yeah,
with life
true.
itself. So if we're clear on what we want in our day, we'll be more present with it. This is yoga. Now, hatha yoga, it's another thing because it's a formal practice that allows us to
Yeah,
develop this presence. Does everybody have time and space for that? Maybe not. Maybe they don't have time for 1 hour in a day. But does everyone have the opportunity to be totally and completely present with what it is that they are engaged with in the dharma of their lives and the purpose of their lives? Absolutely. But we have to be clear. We have to be clear that we're alive, that we've been given this day, that we are an actor in the day also. If
Yeah.
that hasn't come yet, then we can't really live out yoga. That's one thing. And Ayurveda,
But
yes.
do you think, like, I mean, it's a sense of awareness that we are discussing here. I mean, like from moment to moment, having that awareness and living for the day and knowing your purpose. Do you think that somewhere when you actually practice the yoga practices, maybe Hatha yoga or any kind of yoga practices that you get into, asana practice or meditation or breath work, whatever, brings you closer to that awareness as compared to somebody who says that, okay, let me first build the awareness and get into the practice?
I think this is a difficult question to answer because, as we know, we all come with our own tendencies, our own mental imprints, you know, our samskaras, our vasanas. And I've seen beings who have practiced for 40 years And somehow in the daily life, it hasn't translated so strongly. I've seen other beings who have had a strong practice and a strong translation into their daily lives. And I've seen some beings who come fresh. You know, like last weekend, we had a meditation retreat, just a one-day retreat. And there was a couple of beings who were fresh to meditation, and it was like natural water. You know, I could see like the stillness and silence of their being. Mm. So it's a hard one to answer, although what we can see and what you and I probably, the reason we love yoga practice, yoga sadhana, is because it has fruits. It bears fruits in our daily life. I know for myself, I was quite, you know, rajas, this agitation or stimulation, was quite active since I was a child. And so having a yoga practice, having a meditative sadhana was so important because it acquainted me with more silence, more stillness, more steadiness in my movements, in my mind, you know, really not projecting to the future, because that was especially a tendency for me, you know?
Yeah. I think I sail in the same boat. I guess it's more of Rajas people who look for that stability, that silence, that, you know, just stand still kind of a feeling, and that pulls you more towards these practices.
Yes, absolutely. So I think they are of the utmost benefit, and that's the reason that I share them. But I still like to highlight that the highest yoga is really how we're positioned in our days. Like, what's the asana we take in our days? What's the posture we take in our days? How are we with other beings? How are we when we do the simple acts of the day that we do every day? When we eat, when we bathe, when we start the day, how we are with our families, how we move when we're in our career or whatever our chosen job might be. What's the position that we take there? And that's really important. And I suppose that also relates to something you mentioned at the beginning, which is, I see a huge fad towards asana as fitness here, but really a lack of translation into our daily lives. And I say that without any kind of, you know, negativity about the gift of yoga that's entered the Western sphere, but more about a necessity I see for awareness, for not diluting the teachings, like really living it, really living it out.
And that's so beautiful. I guess I really love that point that, and I think, yes, if you kind of contemplated it, that's true that anyways you're living life, if it's little awareness about what time you're eating, what time you're bathing, what is the first thing that you're doing while you're waking up, I think that kind of justifies that you're flowing with the flow of the day rather than doing things mindlessly.
Yes, absolutely.
Great. So, Tiffany, another thing that comes to my mind is we know that yoga and Ayurveda, sister sciences, they're kind of very closely interwoven. And for the people who are associated with the both, with both the modalities, do understand that it's not wise and it's not easy to separate out the two modalities. Still, when we see people practicing, not many people you'll come across who are aware of these two as together. Yes. Most people would either be practicing yoga or Ayurveda. So, basis your experience, learnings, or teachings, what do you think people who are practicing either of these two modalities, either yoga or Ayurveda, are missing in their life or in their practice as compared to when the two come together?
I'm so glad you asked this question, Deepti, because I've seen this, and you know, I've often said in teacher trainings as well, I don't know how I could possibly share or practice within my own life. I use that word lightly, practice, let's say live the gift of yoga without Ayurveda and vice versa. I mean, they're not even sisters, you know? It's like in many ways, they're transparent to each other. There's many paths, as we know, right? Yeah. And you know this so clearly. And so I see such an importance, for example, in the yogic practice. Let's just give a very practical example. This morning I was here teaching a yoga class and the weather was beginning to become humid and rainy. And so there was a dampness and a stickiness in the space. And immediately in the recognition of the elements and the fact that it was creating sort of a pitta vitiation, I could see the way in which people were sweating more. There was more heat, you know, that was starting to happen. This hot dampness that was occurring. We did a specific pranayama. So we worked with Shivaji Pranayama to help to bring some coolness because I could see all this heat that was generated. And of course, understanding that also we're in pitta season and seeing pitta aggravation in the students and in specific students. But if we don't have that knowledge, we can't impart it and we can't practice it for ourselves. And so we just take a yogic practice like a recipe. This is how I think of it with Ayurveda also. We take a recipe, we say Khichdi is Ayurvedic, and then we make the same Khichdi recipe all four seasons, no matter what's going on in this system or that system. This is not Ayurveda. Ayurveda means to know life. So we need to know life in the presence of now. And the yoga is to be united with that and to see this khichdi specifically needs to be with these vegetables or these qualities of oils or these specific spicings.
Yeah.
Yoga of cooking, right? So those ways, they need to be so deeply, I feel so, so deeply paired. And similarly with Ayurveda, of course it deals with if there's dis-ease in this physicality, in this body, or there's dis-ease, yes, mentally, emotionally also. But yoga, especially in its meditative awareness focus, says if there's dis-ease in the being, in, you know, without connection to Atman, then we really need to solve that also for there to be a totality, a complete freedom. Yeah. So they need to be married. They can't not be married. They're already married. They can't get divorced.
Exactly. They can't get divorced. That's a nice one. Yeah, but I totally relate to what you say. I think I tell you what, like, as a person, when I am very high on energy and pitta kind of a personality, and I could very deeply relate to the Ashtanga Vinyasa practice. When I started my yoga practice, I was more into power yoga. And that's what actually I started my, you know, teachings with. And I realized that I love that practice, but by the end of the day, I'm like completely gone with my energy. There's no more energy to do anything else in my practice. But you know, there was a kind of ego that no, because I like it, I'll keep doing it.
Yes.
Over years, I realized that yes, that practice does make me achieve my fitness goals. But is it actually serving my life? Because somewhere I get irritated when I have to kind of, you know, do something extra, or at home if I have to put my extra energy doing some work, or, you know, catering to the kids and all of that. I realized that there is some missing link there. And that's where I think I kind of banged on Ayurveda to figure out that for my personality type, for my age, for the kind of situations or environment that I am in, for the kind of responsibilities that I have, maybe this practice is not working, you know, even if it is working for my fitness goals. But for my life, it's not working. Then I kind of mellowed it down. I brought it to more of hatha practices, holding practices, you know, and, you know, fixed kind of sequences. And I realized that I'm able to do way better than when I was practicing more intense form of practices. So I think that's where I realized that how two are together, because it helps you understand what situation you are in, what person you are, how you in the moment, what is the need of the hour. And that gives you a clear map.
Absolutely. Oh, I love your sharing of that, because that's your personal experience is like one that I've heard many, many times. You know, we get this egoic relationship with and this gripping onto this is my practice and how I need to practice it and how I need to do it.
Exactly.
But a right relationship is to really recognize this vihara chikitsa, like the medicine of lifestyle, to really say, what's the lifestyle that's being asked of me now? Exactly. With children, with a dynamic life. I need actually a practice that brings more calm and serenity rather than one that brings like power yoga, for example.
Exactly. In my practice also, like with the clients, because I was more working on the dietary side with the clients coming from the macrobiotic, way of life initially. And I had a lot of female clients in their perimenopausal stage, late 30s and getting into their 40s. And one of them was like classic case who had severe bouts of migraine, and she used to kind of faint because of migraine. And she was, I think she was doing this intense gymming for 2 hours a day. And it was coming from a space of ego. When we got into conversation, I realized that somewhere she's so obsessed that if I don't do this one day, somewhere I'll end up piling up weight, or you know, because I'm moving towards an age where I need to put more focus on myself. So her understanding of taking care of herself was more from the space of obsessiveness, intensity, which was not working for her. So we kind of mellowed down a lot of things, and you know, naturally the things started changing for her.
Yes. And what in that case, how many times have we seen that actually, especially in the case of women, they overdo and they overdo fitness or exercise, which of course increases cortisol. And then what do we have? We have actually holding of weight. I mean, this is the irony of it. So I've had many that I've suggested do some restorative yoga. Let's do more of a passive practice. Let's actually pull it back. And they're like, I'm losing weight. How am I losing weight?
I know. It's a practical question that you come across. Yes.
Which really shows right alignment again, knowing life, right? This ongoing openness to know our lives and to see really what the medicine is in any given moment.
Exactly.
Yeah, I love these examples.
No, but I have a separate question for females, because I think I really want to cater to that question considering the experiences that I had with the females, but I'll talk of it later. So I think I'll just go with the flow. So most people in the West, this is again a curious question. You know, most people in the West are inclined towards activity, you know, power yoga or Ashtanga Vinyasa style, really intense kind of asana. And you have been kind of practicing yoga and Ayurveda in West for almost like 40 years, you mentioned, right?
Now it's been almost 20 years.
20 years. Oh, yeah. Great. So, So, you know, coming from a space of spirituality, coming from a space of Hatha Yoga, which is more about asana, much more than asana, brings in a lot of spiritual side, brings in eight limbs of, you know, yoga into the practice, and also bringing in Ayurveda at the time when I think it was very new to the Western community. So, how did that impact your way of propagating this yoga, traditional, rather classical yoga and Ayurveda, to the audience, which was more inclined towards activity, intensity, movement, and all of that?
Yes, this has been an ongoing guru. This has been an ongoing teacher for me as well, because obviously for some reason, right, which we could call karma and dharma, I was born here in Canada, right? And then for some reason, I was also compelled to this beautiful blessing of a tradition that's not necessarily from my intergenerational ancestry. It's not from my ancestry. Maybe we could say that. Who knows? Who knows where ancestry
is? Yeah, you never know. Maybe, yeah, exactly. You never know. Something pulled you to India, so maybe some background, definitely.
So this occurred, and this unique combination occurred. And I have again and again just been in wonderment about that. Why that unique combination? But the heart feels pulled to it. So I say yes. I say yes. And in that way, in coming back, which also was a pull, because for some time I felt to stay more in the East, like to stay between India, and I was also living in Thailand for some time, and also actually in South America, but I felt to return to Canada. Part of the Dharma was how to share this in service, really in true service, to beings here who may not be so familiarized with Ayurveda or classical offerings of yoga, etc. And so at times I've really had to humble myself to, we have to start at the building blocks of this. Many of the principles, for example, in India, which we don't need to discuss, they're already understood, even by the common household. Yeah. They need to be discussed and they need to be understood here. For example, I mentioned Mahabhutas, the five elements, the idea that this body and this greater body of the universe is made of five elements, and that those five elements are always in dance and play. That's something we have to start right at the beginnings from.
Yeah, exactly. So
it has been, I won't say a challenge, but it's been a beautiful uncovering, you know, of how to really be of service. But what I have seen, Deepti, is that for those who feel called to it, what a transformation. Because evermore here, it's so needed. We're so far gone, like I referenced before. Many of my Indian family friends that, you know, still live there, or even like yourself, live elsewhere, they still follow some of the principles. The principles are in their homes.
Yeah, definitely. Right? Yeah. I remember at my household, it's a lot of, if I kind of join the dots, a lot of Ayurveda practices, which I learned later, were already a part of my ancestry, definitely.
Exactly. Yet here, we're so far gone, even from some of the ancestral practices that might have been more from some of the cultural backgrounds that we have, even those, you know, in the world of growing capitalism and whatever we might call it, commercialism, they've been so lost. And so because of that, when we enter with just some of the simple, like Dinacharya, when we enter with simple daily routine or the simple practices of, you know, beginning with a small sadhana every day of yoga or pranayama, you know, or pranayama as part of the yoga, we really start to see marked changes in people's lives, in their mental health, in their spiritual health, like really their connection to themselves and their souls, and in their physical health. Like, it's a huge, huge shift. It has such an impactful change. And so in that way, I feel ongoingly so inspired, you know, so inspired by the beings who come.
So I think it's events about classical or, you know, even bringing in Ayurveda, it's just stay with the, I mean, most of your work is with the basics and with the changes that a person feels automatically, they're drawn towards deeper into it.
It's so true, right? It's like, you know, when someone eats khichdi maybe for the first time, to use that example, they're like, what is this different flavor profile?
I know.
And then after a couple of times, they're like, I'm really liking this in my digestion.
I feel like, I know.
Why do I feel so, you know, right? Or, you know, even in here, you know, something that I'll do for people who want to switch to having just a mono diet time or a more plant-based time and a more cleansing, you know, a more langana kind of diet. Then I'll say, okay, and they come to me referencing khichdi. I'll say, but let's make it in a more kind of Mediterranean spicing. You're from an Italian background? it's okay. Mm-hmm. We can do it with some oregano, yeah, with some basil, but we can still pair mung beans and rice, you know, or maybe quinoa. So there's beautiful, yeah, ways that we can actually weave things together as well.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Definitely. Okay. So since we are talking of Hatha Yoga, Tiffany, and we know that, you know, prevalence of Hatha Yoga as compared to the intense forms of practices is lesser in Western countries. It's more of, you know, classical stuff that's kind of you find in India. But since you've been practicing here more of the Hatha Yoga concepts, how do you think people actually gel with these practices? So when I'm saying Hatha Yoga, what I mean by that is the spirituality side of it, which may mean, you know, eight limbs of yoga, which boils down to yamas, niyamas, and then moving on to asanas, and then bringing in those yogic kriyas for detoxification, or bringing in meditation for mind, or, you know, bringing in these aspects of bhakti yoga or karma yoga. Do you think people associate with all these concepts as a part of yoga practice? Do they understand that?
Well, I think some do. I think
some, yeah, I mean, you'll find people with some mental,
I think some do, but I think it's really whether or not there is a vidya, wisdom of what's available. If no one is sharing it, you know, I had a dear friend the other day, we were together chanting bhajans, and she said to me, you know, until now, no one was aware of Hanuman Chalisa, you know, here in this area, like they're not really chanting it. Or she said, so I was never chanting it because they don't know it, so then they can't chant along with it. So I would just go back to a few basic, you know, mantras, but people are loving the chanting, and they're also discovering parts of bhakti yoga that and themselves through it. She said, so then I just started chanting it, and people are beginning to learn it. It's just an introduction, right? So if we don't introduce it. So what I have noticed with this, and the interesting thing is that we call hatha yoga as though it's a style of yoga. But as you and I know, actually, Deepti, like under Raja Yoga, we have this, or let's just say, as a branch in and of itself, any physical yoga, in fact, is Hatha Yoga. Now, whether under that Hatha Yoga, it becomes Ashtanga or Iyengar or Bikram or whatever it becomes, right? It's all Hatha Yoga. But a lot of them have forgotten, not necessarily those, but a lot of them have forgotten these eight limbs. They've forgotten the true Ashtanga of it, right? So teaching the true Ashtanga, I find such a receptivity, like such a beautiful receptivity. Mm. We have a small shala here, and we have our small classes, you know, where I can really teach in basically semi-private.
And way. It's beautiful, as like what shows on screen is just beautiful. Oh, the kind of shala, and the aura actually comes out of the screen. That
you've created. I'm so glad. I'm so glad. And it's so beautiful to see, Deepti, because people you would never imagine, if you were to generalize or judge from the mind, they come, and they came 2 years ago when we opened this shala here, and they continue to come every week, a couple times a week. So for certain people who have that depth of contact with it. But I think it takes, you know, it's like acquiring a taste. Because at the beginning, if we're used to just the fitness practice, I go, I sweat, you know, I do it in a hot room.
Yeah, it starts there, but it's just the beginning into a huge different world.
Entirely. Entirely. And what are we all yearning for? I mean, no matter what we're doing in our lives, there's one singular interest, which is to be more happy. I mean, that's the motivator, whatever it is that we're doing. So if it offers that, which it does, of course, it offers reprieve from suffering, then of course, we're all interested. Like, oh, okay, what are these yamas and niyamas? What are these pranayamas that allow me to access parts of myself I never knew, you know, existed? So I see a real receptivity, but it requires a taste, you know.
I guess you said that right, because I had the same question from my teacher. So I am a graduate from Shivananda School in India, Madurai. So one of my teachers, she's actually a Canadian, and she's kind of moved. So she's working for Shivananda School in Madurai now. She's handling all, I mean, she's a teacher also, but she's taking care of all those Shivananda ashrams in India. So I had the same question from her as well, like how people in the West take, you know, understand yoga, and how, like, how this entire thing, how could you merge this spiritual side with in your practice, like in Canada? So she just mentioned that there were two things. One, of course, if you're staying there and if you want to bring in that awareness of all these practices there, it all starts with small little things of educating them. Like, you know, for us, maybe we belong to the land where it happened. We've seen it in our family, so it comes very natural to us. But you have to really start from the beginning here, starting to talk about those concepts and say, okay, these concepts are actually documented. These are there. This is how life is. And then gradually moving on from there. But for her, she took a different call. Maybe she said, okay, I wanted to be in the land where it all happened and, you know, where I want to go deeper. So I want to start from a certain base moving on forward. So it's how you take it forward, I believe.
Absolutely. And both are best. You know, they say in the Tibetan tradition, both are best. And it feels like that.
Exactly.
Both are best. Exactly. I've loved, you know, sharing with those who have a strong meditative background. But also there's something so beautiful, for example, with a beginner's heart. You know, when we come as a beginner and we really take that beginner's humility, it's so beautiful to see. Like people, you know, they say, I don't know, but I'm teachable. I'm really open and I'm teachable. And that's so inspiring as well. And these little bits, I mean, how did I take it as well? I knew nothing about any of these things at the beginning.
Yeah.
Right. So.
Yeah. I agree. But that's the beauty of this practice. It's I think it doesn't take long for you to realize this is a different way of living life. This is a different path.
Okay.
Great. So now, since we are talking of Hatha Yoga, Tiffany, another question that I have is, Hatha Yoga has a very strong focus on cleansing yourself, detoxification, and the specific kriyas which the Hatha Yoga practices, incorporate for you to be practiced every single day. Like Ayurveda has its own cleansing practices or its own routine. Similarly, there's not much in yoga. Please correct me if I'm wrong, but there are still certain practices which focuses on the concept of detoxification. So this concept of cleanse or detoxification is very common in yoga. In its own way, and in Ayurveda in its own way, in the form of Dinacharya or, you know, various practices coming together. And this concept of detoxification is also a modern phenomena, right? I mean, how do you think this concept of detox in Ayurveda or ancient modalities is different from this concept of detox, which is more of a modern phenomenon?
Yes, yes. What an important question and a great question. And I imagine you've contemplated this a lot in that you asked the question. And that you work a lot with this also, you know, with your own rogis, with your own clients and people who come to you.
Yeah.
Because as we see here, we all, again, we have an interest in something, which is to be happier and to be more well in this body. So because of that, we see these detoxification practices, fasting, intermittent fasting, you know, the various juice dieting, right? There's all these different practices.
Yeah.
And maybe, you know, it's not even about being well, maybe it's about losing weight, right? But that is about being happier. I mean, it always leads there. Like, I want to be happier. This is, you know,
I think in the, as a modern phenomena, basis my experience with some of the people that I've worked with, I feel people don't even realize that it may lead to happiness. I mean, that's a far off thought for them initially. It's just that detox maybe for a small little goal that, okay, I overate in last few months, so let me just detox. So there's not even a purpose to their detox. It's just that because it's a phenomenon, it's everywhere, so let's try that.
That everybody's doing it, absolutely. And so I think when we consider this applied to the understandings from yoga, like you were sharing, Shatkarma Kriya, like the understandings of the kriyas and the cleansings that we see in yoga, and then the Ayurvedic understandings around cleansing, we can see that yoga and Ayurveda have much to offer us in the West around this detoxification. And if people are interested in cleansing, in detoxing, I feel it's so important that they become more versed in the understandings of seasonality, of bioindividuality. So, you know, what's the season and how is it going to affect me if I do a juice fast in the middle of January versus I do it in the middle of July? It has totally different impacts, but most of us don't know that. So I find these people doing a green juice fast, and afterwards they're totally depleted, they're completely scattered, they have a vata imbalance, right? Obviously.
Yeah, I agree to that. I've gone through this phase, so I know what you're saying.
Yeah. Versus July. Okay, it's still not good for everybody. And similarly, if I have a client who's in her 70s versus I have a woman in her mid-30s, who wants to do some, you know, aspect of intermittent fasting where she, you know, only has two meals a day versus three, that's going to have a very different impact based upon the stage of life, which is also an understanding we have from Ayurveda, and that we always look at before any cleansing, before Panchakarma or Shamana or Shodana, we always look at what's the age of the patient, the strength of the patient, the ojas, their vitality. All of those things have to be considered before we go into detoxification. So here, I feel all of those things are ignored. And even pre-detoxification and post-detoxification are completely ignored. So it could be today, you know, I eat my cheese pizza, my lasagna for dinner, whatever, you know, have a bunch of, you know, maybe drink some alcohol because tomorrow I know that I'm going to have my detox, but it's okay. Yeah. Start in the morning and just detox. There is no cultural understanding and no, I would say, holistic medicinal understanding that that can do more harm than good. Preparation and also the gentle release afterwards are so necessary. So I always suggest to those that do somehow have an entry point to discuss with me, say before you do any detox or cleanse, please speak to myself or another who is somewhat versed also in maybe yoga or Ayurveda or even TCM, traditional Chinese medicine, or other traditions that really follow a specific protocol that looks at seasonality, individuality, etc. You know, before we detoxify.
So what's your take on intermittent fasting? I guess in terms of detoxification, it's quite a word these days, and specifically also because it's being propagated in the medical side as well. With a lot of functional medicine practitioners are recommending it, and a lot of people are, you know, mindlessly just getting into it. And most of them fail on it. I must mention that.
Yes.
They start and they feel more depleted than being more rejuvenated.
Yes. I'm glad that you asked because it has become such a fad. There are these periods of fads, right? Like, you know, a few years ago, it was like celery juice. Everyone's drinking celery juice. Then, you know, this winter, everybody's going into baths of ice cubes. And, you know, like we have all these.
Yeah, that's the latest trend, yes.
Right? Yeah. And then we have this intermittent fasting. I would say, one out of two, if not more than that, 70% currently of my rogis, of the patients who come, tell me they're trying out or they have been trying out, new patients, not the ones that have been with me for some time. They've been trying out intermittent fasting. And this is what I hear, that the intermittent fasting means that they skip breakfast. And this, see, from an Ayurvedic context, we actually always suggested what we might call intermittent fasting, but it was more right timing and what we could call ahara chikitsa, the proper timing of taking certain inputs, including our food. So dietary timings were so important and something that's always acknowledged in Ayurveda.
I think in India, if I reflect back on how the households have been, like how we've also been, you know, grown up in our families. Like I remember we used to stay in a hill station in my childhood, and my father, he made sure that we finish our dinner by, say, maximum by 7:30, 7 or 7:30. And by the time you start your day and you have your breakfast, there's automatically a gap of those many hours, and you were practicing it day in and day out. I mean, that was a lifestyle. It's not that we were doing it, say, maybe during some seasons or as a specific part of a detox. So I think that really helped us kind of, you know, build us the way we are.
Absolutely. And this is what Ayurveda always suggested, which was to have your last meal not too late, to have it actually, if you can, before the sun goes down. And that way you can really digest fully. But because there has been a glorification of the 9-to-5 workday and of money, we've made dinner be the primary meal, which never should have been the primary meal. So no one wants to skip dinner. But people going off to work, skipping breakfast, and bleeding themselves in the morning, and leading to also, you know, this blood glucose going up and down.
Yeah.
So, like all of the contributing factors, doesn't really provide a field of human beings that are going to be happy and healthy. So if we miss anything, and this is what I'll say to individuals, if we're going to miss any of the meals, let it be dinner, or let be dinner be small, and let it be earlier. But the other thing to consider, it's what we said before about detoxification, is to who? Because Ayurveda always looks at to who, like who's the specific individual. Grandma should probably not be intermittent fasting. She needs all the nourishment she can get. You know, like it really depends on the
because of depletion already happening in her body.
Absolutely, right? So we need to look at what's the phase of life. And of course, we don't put, you know, our 7-year-old children on an intermittent fasting regime.
Yeah.
We know that, you know, firstly, they wouldn't be able to follow it, but secondly, but also for all of us to look at, if you're already someone who's quite thin, you're someone who doesn't have a strong, what we call an ojas, a strong vitality, doing a lot of fasting or intermittent fasting in that way, you know, really restricting a meal or going 16 hours or 18 hours is not going to be actually wonderful for your metabolism, for bone density, for muscle wasting. I mean, there's so many long-term factors that can occur actually to create more ailment than good by improper intermittent fasting. So these fads are based on one size fits all. And Ayurveda is the very opposite of that. Yoga is the very opposite of that. It says no.
Opposite of that, true.
It's about acquainting yourself with your specific needs in any given moment, being present to what is.
Yeah, true. Yes. But that's so beautiful. And again, it's a matter of awareness.
It is, right? It truly is.
Yeah. Great. Yeah. So another thing, from the idea of detoxification, that again, that's a curious question at my end, because I've seen both the worlds. When I was more on the diet side, gradually I moved on to yoga and Ayurveda, but my beginning in wellness happened with the foods. And so I was doing a lot of such kind of cleanses, and specifically, I guess the most important, the most talked about cleanse rather is lemon water in the morning, first warm lemon water as you wake up. Yeah. And then there are different approaches to how you can detox in the morning. One way is have warm lemon water. If you move towards Ayurveda would recommend bringing in some spices, or maybe having some cumin water or coriander water. I couldn't actually ever understand this concept that when we are talking detox, if lemon is also giving you a detox, and if maybe cumin water is also giving you a detox, how do the two vary? Is it the energetics of the food that we are talking here, which is separate, or is there anything in nutrition that kind of makes them separate? Or so if you could just kind of help me understand that.
Yes, I love it. Yeah, I mean, what is really in the original text of Ayurveda is to at least start the day with warm water. Just there is where it begins, to start the day with warm water. I think even there, Deepti, it's really important. Yeah. The listeners as well.
And that's there in all the cultures. Like if you look at TCM, they have hot water therapy like for the morning. So I think hot water is the base.
Yeah, it is the base. And to start with warm water. And most individuals are not doing that. Most people are not doing that. We're starting with coffee or we're starting with, I don't know, what other drinks are happening, juice, something else. And so even starting with warm water, because of course, if this system is made mostly of jala, if it's mostly made of waters, the waters of this body, the lymph of this body, then also for what we call in Ayurveda, this channel from the mouth until the anus, which is called the Purisha Vahashrota, like the waste channel, it needs to be cleared every morning. And how many issues do we have with digestive health, with eliminatory health? We have so many issues that just this warm water would be a cure. We lost you.
Yeah, so Tiffany, I guess there's some connection issues at your end, I see. We'll wait for you to be back here.
Yeah. Are we back?
Yes, yeah.
Flowing or frozen?
Yeah, it's a little slow, but I think it's back.
It's a little slow.
Yeah.
Okay, let me know. It's not flowing. Are you hearing me now?
Now it's better. Yes.
So drinking of the warm water is like in the most powerful ways we can cleanse this whole channel right away in the morning. The warmth of it is one thing, because the body, if it's cold, the body responds by contracting, but the warmth allows the body to melt and release. And the warmth and the water also is deeply hydrating. And we need hydration, especially when we wake up, for our digestion, for starting the day, for our elimination. We know all of these principles. So even the water. Now, the other qualities, what we call the qualities, absolutely, in Ayurveda, we have what we call the rasa, the taste of the foods. We have also what we call the virya, potency of the foods, if it's heating or cooling. And so there are, and then as you know, as a nutritionist also, there are, of course, the specific macro and micronutrient aspects to each one of these things. So cumin versus lemon. And lemon is quite alkaline. So we introduced this to the body, which most people are surprised by because it's an acidic fruit. But we take this into the body and it creates an alkaline response. And that alkaline environment is the kind of environment that we want for healing rather than disease. We see that most diseases can propagate, they can find residence in an acidic environment. So Ayurveda says things that later on holistic science or holistic, nutritional science is also saying, oh, okay, there's scientific ways that we can, account for what Ayurveda might have always said, which is drink your warm water. And yes, it can be good to drink it with this or this. Cumin has other properties. It's what we call in more Western herbalism, we might call a carminative, which means it's really good for gas and bloating. And so always known with Ayurveda that if we take cumin or we take, you know, this jirapani, like we take this cumin water, boiled cumin or coriander in the water, that it brings more neutrality to the system. It's not too hot. It's not too cool. It has a nice gentle warming, and it's very good to stimulate the digestion. So this morning after yoga, we had CCF. So we have CCF.
That's one of my favorites for sure.
Coriander for the day. And everybody was like, wow.
And it works amazingly. It works amazingly. You be onto it continuously and you see how your system starts to just flow.
It's just amazing, right? How it can work. Just simple things. And these are the simple things we talked about before, that just those entry points of drinking some more water in the morning or having a CCF tea once or twice a day. Mm-hmm. What a difference we can notice. And if our tummy is well and our elimination is well, then, you know, we really release yesterday, literally, and come into the day fresh.
That's so, so true. Yeah.
These principles are very simple, but very beautiful.
Yeah, great. Okay, so Tiffany, on the spiritual side, like specifically, you know, from on the food side and you know, just to maintain your practice on the spiritual side, like when you're bringing yoga and Ayurveda together, what kind of food practices would you recommend or do you recommend, you know, to the people who are taking away your teachings or coming to you for the practices? So is there any science or energetic logic to the kind of diet that you recommend, or is it the Ayurveda principles getting blended into the, you know, yogic diet principles? How do you approach that?
Yes, I really approach it depending upon the individual in front of me.
Okay.
Yeah. So again, I look at who is it that's in front of me, which I think, you know, and you do as well. But I can see that in the field of my sharing, one of the main things that I end up working with, because I work with people all around the world, I also have a lot of Zoom consultations as well, which many people think, you know, because we also do pulse and we do tongue, but sometimes, you know, I can't take the physical pulse, but I can take the pulse of the moment. So and the pulse of that being through Zoom. So I see people, but mostly Westerners around the world. And the one thing that I consistently orient to is, can we make the diet a bit more sattvic? Mm-hmm. Full stop. And what does that mean? A little bit more whole. Can we make the diet more whole, more local, more organic, more seasonal, more complete? Can we have more regularity? This is the other thing with Ayurveda. It's not just about what we eat, and yoga also focuses on this, but the timing and how we eat. So there's a yogic practice, there's an Ayurvedic practice, a sadhana of how it is that we eat as well. The portion that we eat, the presence that we're in when we eat, how we cook our food as well. So really considering those three areas, like what we eat is important, but also how we eat and how we prepare the food. All three are really crucial. And so usually my entry point for most people is, can we make it a little bit more pure? A little bit more clean, a little more wholesome. And that can look like ridding the pantry and also the fridge of preservative filled things, of lots of packaged things or preservative things, or things that have all sorts of hidden preservatives, sulfites, you know, sugars, all of those things. Just starting there. But of course, there's a huge field of people who are already there. They've already done that cleanup. Then if they've already done that cleanup, then I look a little more individualized based upon the principles of Ayurveda. What's their unique constitution? What's their dosha? And how can we maintain their dosha in alignment by the foods that they eat every day and the way they eat, right? And the way they eat, because my Vata person will
It's like layer by layer approaching.
Exactly. Approaching. Absolutely. Yeah. I don't know if that answers the question that you're asking.
No, that does. I mean, what I was thinking alongside was it's so, I mean, again, the language is different, but the concept is still the same. Like, I got to study some part of traditional Chinese, the basics of traditional Chinese medicine as a part of my macrobiotic certification. And I was just thinking of that, like Ayurveda, like when it is about diet and foods would be the last thing that Ayurveda would look into. It would look into, as you said, the timings, how you cook, how you consume. And similarly, it's the same in TCM as well. Foods would be the last thing that TCM would look into. The first thing they would look into is that how your organ systems are processing that food. Is your machinery efficient enough to process even the simplest foods? That's what makes those foods powerful.
Yes. I love that. And of course, that's a huge focus of Ayurveda as well. We have to take care of the relationship between Agni, between our digestifier, and Ama, the amount of toxicity in the system. to see whether or not we can even digest, exactly as you said, the simplest of input. Yeah. It's like if we're over inundated, right, even through visual imagery, or we're over inundated through auditory input as well. Even the nicest sound or even the nicest sight could be too much.
Yeah.
And so similarly, you know, this oral input, if we're over inundated, if we just, you know, we can't take even another morsel of anything. So we have to see, you know, whether or not the digestion is prepared. And we do a lot of that in Ayurveda as well, this preparation of the digestion.
No, that's nice, because I really like that point that most often we, you know, we get carried away by this food has this nutrition, or this exercise is good for this, or this yoga is good for this. I think the biggest problem is we don't know how much is too much for each individual. Like for me, my too much would be a little more than somebody else's too much.
Yes.
So, and that's where I think Ayurveda pitches in, telling you, you know, exactly what is good for you. Okay. So Tiffany, my next question is more, as I said, like I want to go back to the female health, because that's what has been my forte in my practice as well. And out of personal interest as well, like, you know, if I go back and see how my grandparents, or, you know, generations before that back in India used to work, the kind of work that they used to do, the kind of lifestyles they had, irrespective of that. And they used to work hard. They really used to work hard. I mean, they used to start early in the morning making, you know, preparing food for everybody. And before that, you know, getting into bathing and doing all their prayers, and then getting into the kitchen and starting to cook. So there was a level of spirituality, even though it was not obvious to them that that's how it should be, but it was a part of their way of life. And I realized that if I look back at my grandma, you know, the generations before, they hardly, specifically the female related health problems were rarely heard of, like PCOD, PCOS, or maybe, you know, specific health concerns that women face in today's times. So as compared to women today who are more sailing in this zone of masculine energies, not balancing the feminine energies. So, you know, hello, Tiffany, are you there? I think people again lost her. So, okay, Tiffany, we'll wait for you. I think there's another signal problem again there. So, guys, we'll have to wait a little. I think there is some signal problem at Tiffany's end. Hello? Okay, so I think she'll join back again. We are still left with about 10 minutes of our session. So yeah, in the meantime, I think since we are talking yoga and Ayurveda as a lifestyle, Tiffany has given us really good inputs around how, you know, just by following simple techniques, simple practices, you can still be, you know, still be on the path of following this yoga and Ayurveda way of life. And it's simple, you know, bringing in some small little practices, daily practices, committing yourself to the practices and being aware in the moment. That's what it takes to start your practices. So hi, Tiffany. In the meantime, I was just concluding, you know, whatever you mentioned. So, yes. Yeah. So, yeah, I was just talking about women's health. Yeah. So looking at how the females live their lives today and the kind of lifestyles they have, in previous times, there was this balance of masculine energies and feminine energies. Females were doing a lot of work, but there was a balance of work in terms of, you know, what work needs their intensity, in what work they find their solace and peace and relaxation, which is not there now. Yes. It's and the modern world does not realize that how important it is to create balance between masculine and feminine. So from the yoga and Ayurveda as a lifestyle, you know, what would be your suggestions to women who are sailing in this boat of more of masculine energies?
Yes. Wow. What an important question, and maybe a controversial question also, right? Because this delineation of the masculine and the feminine world seems to be something that in the Ayurvedic and the yogic teachings, there's a direct impression of this, like the hatha actually comes from the sun and the moon, or the merging together of the masculine and the feminine, or the Shakti and the Shiva and the Shakti. So we have this understanding much wider than the sexes, but really an understanding that there is this absolute pairing, this consort of life, this like beautiful.
These are universal characteristics, I would say. I mean, beautiful. Hot, cold, good, bad.
Yes.
All those adjectives associated with that.
Absolutely. And even when we look to the whole pantheon of devatas, you know, of gods and goddesses, and we can see the marriage, right, of the energies also between, yeah, for example, Sita Ram and etc. Right. So we know, yeah, that exists there. And of course, this is being questioned, like, why can't women do what men are doing and men can't do, you know, what women are doing? And
yeah,
but we also do see a collective field of unwellness, like you mentioned. And especially when we look to the hormonal or the reproductive sphere, we need to ask ourselves, because those are the specific, like the hormonal level is the specific things that are relegated to one sex or another. So we need to ask ourselves, why is it that we're seeing in women, as you mentioned, a lot of issues in the reproductive hormonal realm or the reproductive sphere? Like, I see a lot of women now in, yeah, the area of, let's just say it very openly, vaginal health, etc., that are dealing with a lot of various diseases and ailments,
yeah,
and also thyroid health. So, you know, we see that this phenomena is happening. And as you mentioned, Deepti, what is it in the current context?
Hi, Tiffany. Can you hear me?
I can. Do you hear me?
Yeah, I do. Then there's some lag there, but I can. Yeah.
What's happening? So, see that this is occurring for women, and then to question, mm-hmm, absolutely, how is it? Because as you questioned, what is it in the lifestyle? And that's an Ayurvedic question. Because as I mentioned before, Vihara Chikitsa, the second pillar of medicine, according to Ayurveda, out of three, right? We have diet, lifestyle, and then we also have herbalism. When we look at the second, it's how are you living your life? And how does your life either contribute to great wellness and ease, or the opposite? How does it bring pollution and disease? How is it poisonous for your being, right? So we can see if there's no other indicators, people can be eating actually very, very well, but wrong timings, very rushed, etc. It again comes down to lifestyle, and we can see the way in which they're running homes. And most, yeah, women today are needing to work, or at least that's the idea, that they need to work outside of the home while also running a full home.
Yeah.
And at the same time, being entirely stressed by all of it. Also, as we discussed before, going to the gym to keep up some kind of idea of appeal, you know, and vanity, really, right? Which is very different than the feminine body that was really revered in the,
yeah, past, exactly,
which had, yeah, vitality and roundness and, right, all of these.
Yeah, true.
So even the way in which we're exercising, it's all the lifestyle medicine and what we spend our time doing in pastimes. We rarely have time now, or we give ourselves to spaces of intergenerational connection with our elders, connections with grandparents. You know, you may still have a rich tradition of this, Deepti, but I can say, you know, for most Westerners, this is not something,
exactly,
that is practiced. Yeah.
And it's very new to them.
So much is learned, the way in which we conceive, the way in which we have children, the way in which we're taken care of after children.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole teachings of Ayurveda teach women, your mother and your grandmother, if they can be there, it's a wonderful practice for them to hold you and take care. Most women here think, 1 week I'm off, right? And then off I go.
Yeah.
At least some women, true, think, I should, you know, I should somehow be okay afterwards. What about all of these practices that brought a slow steadiness that allowed women, mm-hmm, to also, during the menstruation, take breaks? I heard recently in Finland or maybe Denmark, they finally have period days. So days that you can have.
Oh, that's nice.
Work. Amazing. Right.
That's so nice. Yeah, exactly. And that's all you need, actually. You just need that rest period of 2 to 3 or 4 days and you're sorted for the month. Yeah.
And this was understood in Ayurveda, and it was understood just even as you said in the culture and the land of, mm-hmm, India, it was understood. But these things are not understood, so women don't even mention that they have their period. They don't even mention that they need to sit down during an intense work day. So all of these things, I think it's a big inquiry. Giving an answer right now would be a difficult one. But having a larger inquiry to really ask ourselves, are we living lifestyles that are medicinal, mm-hmm, specifically for us? And as women, are we living lifestyles that really honor womanhood, that also honor somehow the energy of Shakti, that honor the cycles and the transitions that we have everywhere from menarche to also moving into fertility and then later into menopause. Do we honor any of these cycles? Do we honor these transitions or rite of passage, or, you know, and where are our elders in that? So it's a big inquiry, and I think a beautiful.
I guess it's a huge part of, I think, somewhere science has to step in, because that's the language that a lot of people now understand. So, but it's a cycle in itself. It's not about that PMS thing or a PCOD thing. It's coming from continuously, you know, not adhering to what you need to do during those cycles.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. And do you think bringing in this, like, for because a lot of women, I'm sure, face such problems. So as a part of solution, basic solution from, you know, flowing in from yoga and Ayurveda practices, do you think maybe following some practices of Dinacharya coming from Ayurveda, or practicing some, you know, restorative kind of postures in your in their regular life can actually bring about you know, noticeable changes in the kind of problems they face in their female health on a regular basis?
Absolutely, 100%. It's so significant to witness this, actually. Now, of course, I'm not suggesting in any way that just scraping your tongue each and every day, although it could.
Yeah, of course, I understand. I mean, it's just a holistic, a lot of things have to come together. Yeah.
But I have noticed that all of these provide a gateway of a new way of coming to the beginning of our day, to recognizing what it is to be alive. Like, just scraping the tongue can slow someone down so that the rest of their morning becomes more meditative. They spend less time on Facebook or Instagram. They then decide to drink their warm water. They eat a different type of breakfast, yeah, etc. It has this rolling effect, and that can completely and totally change what's going on in the rhythming of the body, which is, of course, our nervous system and our endocrine system. Those are the rhythms. So when we change our rhythm with the lives we live seasonally and daily, we also start, and we bring more naturalness, then we're more in alignment with life there and more in alignment with life here. And of course, it can bring a huge shift. And I've seen it. I've seen it again and again. People say to me, one of the biggest things, you know, I give this 50-hour Ayurveda course over 4 months. So it's once a week. Mm-hmm. And we do it online. And the biggest thing that they say to me is the impact of really integrating their Dinacharya, that they have a daily routine that they always fall back on, and that that has changed how they want to live their life, how they go to work, how they engage with their family.
I agree.
Whether or not they do a yoga course, etc.
It deeply impacts your choices, I believe. I mean, once you start to feel some positive changes with one choice, you want to make another good choice and another good choice.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. And it's even the reason
I have so...
I was going to say, yeah,
I have so much to discuss with you, I think, but in the interest of time, I think I'll move towards winding up the session for now. So I think my last question to you would be, please help us understand, you know, what is Vichara Yoga and what is Rasa Ayurveda, and how did these two ventures happen to you?
Oh, so beautiful. Yeah, I don't know how they happened. They emerged also from, from my love, of course. They emerged from love. And the only thing I could really name is grace, you know, without saying anything more. There are certain things that we can't say
that just come up,
the how or give really a mental reasoning, but Vichara Yoga really arose because for a long time I was just sharing the gift of yoga, and people would ask, well, what type of yoga, what's the brand of yoga, what's the name of yoga? And of course my teacher also tried to, you know, but he said, this is yoga, this is Hatha Yoga, you know, this is classical Hatha Yoga, we could call it Tantric Hatha Yoga. So in my deep connection with Advaita Vedanta, also with this Atma Vichara, with self-inquiry, I said, okay, we can call it Vichara Yoga, the yoga of inquiry. You know, that while you're, you know, in your Hatha Yoga practice, that it's all for a depth of inquiry, of asking ourselves, who am I? What's this body? What's this day ahead of me? The person that I think I am I truly that being? You know, who am I before I am all my namarupa, all my names and forms and roles that I'm going to go out and play for the day? Mm-hmm. Who am I if I drop those for a moment and really come to my own self-discovery, even here for 30 minutes or for an hour or whatever it might be for us? So that's where Vichara, you know, the name arose from. And really what I share is what I feel is the blessing of true yoga, the presence of embodied inquiry, you know, to be in our embodiment and inquire. And Rasa emerged because in my clinical practice here in Canada, I could not access a good source of all of the apothecary items, the medicine, and the Dinacharya ritual tools that I wanted to give every one of the Rogies that came to me. So I'd find I was sending them websites, trying to get them to order things from the US, bring back bags of things from India each year as I would come back. You know, some would make it, some would not make it. And so I said,
I guess that's how even I found Rasa. I was just trying to figure out certain things.
So I said, let me make a little brand of things just for my own patients, for my own clients. And then it just started to grow. And I hope it will continue to grow, because if it grows, it means Ayurveda is growing. Yes. And that was really to serve Ayurveda.
You're doing a great job, for sure.
Thank you so much, Deepti. So that's how it emerged.
Great. No, thank you so much, Tiffany. It was really, I have another few, questions which I had just leave in between considering time. But I look forward to having you again, maybe, having a discussion on a separate topic. But thank you so much. And on the ending note, is there anything that you would want to add on before we end up our session?
Oh, I just want to end with gratitude. You know, I feel so inspired, and there's like an effervescence, just this excitement that arises deeply from all the questions that you asked. And when I get to sit with another being who is so alive to serving in this way, it's such a beautiful gift. So I hope everyone listening or watching, you can also really support what Deepti is doing, because this is, really such an offering for such a good, such a good cause and such a good offering that can really bring some truth to our lives. So thank you for doing what you do.
Thank you so much. And I guess it's again coming from a place of, as you said, feeling excited and happy about those positive energies which these modalities bring to us. Mm-hmm. So thank you so much, Tiffany, for being there. And it's been a lovely talk. And I think I'll have to re-listen to what you, whatever you spoke. There's so much to take away. So all the best for whatever you're doing. And I'll be definitely in touch. Maybe, we can plan another session where we talk various other different topics.
Let's do that. That would be wonderful. Yes. Thank you so much, Titi.
Thank you so much. Thank you for being there. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.